Good morning. I'm Dick Albert. Most of you know that. And I'm here to speak some words of inspiration, according to the order of service, and to talk about a book that mattered to me. I had no hesitation in knowing what book that would be. More than 64 years ago, I had just escaped the clutches of the cult my mother had brought me in and joined the U.S. Army. A lot of young men, when they go off to the service, take some book, usually a Bible, with them, but I'd had enough of religion. So I took this book, and I don't even remember how I came across it at the age of 19. It's called A Little Treasury of Modern Poetry, edited by Oscar Williams. There's a poem in here too long to read in which Marion Moore says that poetry is what poets create are imaginary gardens with real toads in them. And I did have to share that line with you. I sat down to make a list of a few poems I could share with you from this book to show you what it meant to me in those 3 years in the Army and in many years since. I think it had a lot to do with my attempting to become a poet myself. And so I sat down to write down the list of just a few poems I could share. I ended up with about 25, and I've only been allowed 5 minutes. Well, I don't read that fast, so I have to sort through this in some way. And the first poem I want to read is called Ars Poetica, The Art of Poetry, page 338. This poem by Archibald MacLeish. A poem should be palpable and mute as a globed fruit, dumb as old medallions to the thumb, silent as the sleeve-worn stone of casement ledges where the moss has grown. A poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs, leaving as the moon releases twig by twig, the night-entangled trees. Leaving as the moon behind the winter leaves, memory by memory, the mind. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs. A poem should be equal to, not true. For all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf. For love, the leaning grasses, and two lights above the sea, a poem should not mean, but be. So, where is my list? Sometimes, as a young man, just in the Army, I was drawn to the poems that talked about being a soldier. And since I thought on my way to Korea, I was drawn to some of the poems that talk about war, but I want to start with one that's kind of a light poem. It's a poem by James Stephens, an Irish poet, and it's called A Glass of Beer. The lanky hank of a she in the inn over there nearly killed me for asking the loan of a glass of beer. May the devil grip the waste-faced slut by the hair and beat bad manners out of her skin for a year. That parboiled imp with the hardest jaw you will see on virtue's path and a voice that would raise the dead came roaring and raging the minute she looked at me and threw me out of the house in the back of my head. If I asked her master, he'd give me a cask a day. But she with the beer at hand, not a gill would arrange. May she marry a ghost and bear him a kitten, and may the high king of glory permit her to get the mange. Well, at the age of 19, that impressed me mightily as a great poem. The next one I will share is a little bit more serious. It's back here somewhere. It's by Thomas Hardy, a British poet, wrote about the time of the First World War, most famous for his novels, but one of which has been recently made into a movie, right? Far From the Madding Crowd, is that it? And But he really aspired to be a poet and was a pretty good one. And this is a poem called The Man He Killed. Had he and I but met by some old ancient inn, we should have sat us down to whet right many a nipperkin. But ranged as infantry and staring face to face, I shot at him as he at me and killed him in his place. I shot him dead because he was my foe. Just so, my foe, of course he was. That's clear enough. Although he thought he'd enlist perhaps offhand-like, just as I was out of work, had sold his traps, no other reason why. Yes, quaint and curious war is. You shoot a fellow down, you treat, if met where any bar is, or treat to half a crown. That poem struck me forcefully when I was 19. The next poem is, I'm lost. Also a poem about being young. It's called When I Was 1 and 20 by A.E. Housman. When I was young and 20, I heard a wise man say, give crowns and pounds and guineas, but not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free. But I was 1 and 20, no use to talk to me. When I was 1 and 20, I heard him say again, the heart out of the bosom was never given in vain. 'Tis paid with sighs aplenty and sold for endless rue. And I am 2 and 20, and oh, 'tis true, 'tis true. The next poem is one by a poet I grew to love, probably first encountered him here. His name is Robert Frost. And this poem, and you I'm sure know, it's called Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Can't figure out what I'm doing here. Oh, Emily Dickinson became my favorite poet when I read this book, and still is my favorite American poet. And she wrote a poem called The Snake. I could read 10 of hers, but I won't. The Snake. One of the things poets do is observe things that most of us don't in very amazing ways. I think you'll like this poem. A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rides. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass divides as with a comb. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a child and barefoot, I more than once at morn have passed, I thought a whiplash unbraiding in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people I knew, and they knew me. I felt for them a transport of cordiality, but never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. You read a last line like that, it makes you wish you'd written it. Okay, and the next one, I'm not going to have much more time, so I'm going to go to this last poem I want to read, I think. No, I want to read this other one, 361. I want to read this poem because one of the things poems do is just play with words, and I love the way this poem plays with words. 360. It's called, it's by E.E. Cummings, and it's called Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town? Anyone lived in a pretty how town with up so floating many bells down, spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't, he danced his did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone not at all. They sowed their isn't, they reaped their same, sun, moon, stars, rain. Children guessed, but only a few, and down they forgot as up they grew, autumn, winter, spring, summer, that no one loved him more by more. When by now and tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow and stir by still, anyone's any was all to her. Someone's married their everyone's, laughed their cryings and did their dance, sleep, wake, hope, and then they and their nevers, they slept their dream. Stars, rain, sun, moon, and only the snow can begin to explain how children are up to forget to remember with up so floating many bells down. One day, anyone died, I guess, and no one stooped to kiss his face. Busy folk buried them side by side, little by little, and was by was. All by all, and deep by deep, and more by more, they dream their sleep. No one and anyone, earth by April, wish by spirit, and if by yes. Women and men, both dong and ding, summer, autumn, winter, spring, reaped their sowing, and went there came, sun, moon, stars, rain. I don't know if you're familiar with a painting by Bruegel called The Fall of Icarus. Icarus, from the Greek myth, tried to fly too near the sun. The wax wings melted, not obeying his father, and he fell to his death. And W.H. Auden has a poem called Musée des Beaux-Arts, which is a description, really, of that painting. And he looks at that painting in a way I don't think anyone else has quite seen it. Musée des Beaux-Arts. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along, how when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course, anyone, anyhow in a corner, some untidy spot, where the dogs go on with their doggy life, and the torturer's horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to, on the white legs disappearing into the green water. And the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. And my last poem, I may be going over 5 minutes, but that's okay with me. I want to read this. This is a longish poem, but it's a poem I don't want you to go to your grave without having heard. It's about Sunday morning, and it's about Sunday morning. Complacencies of the peignoir and late coffee and oranges and a sunny chair, and the green freedom of a cockatoo upon a rug mingle to dissipate the holy hush of ancient sacrifice. She dreams a little, and she feels the dark encroachment of that old catastrophe as a calm darkens among water lights. The pungent oranges and bright green wings seem things in some procession of the dead, winding across wide water without sound. The day is like wide water without sound, stilled for the passing of her dreaming feet over the hills to silent Palestine, dominion of the blood and sepulcher. Why should she give her bounty to the dead? What is divinity if it can come only in silent shadows and in dreams? Shall she not find in comforts of the sun, in pungent fruit and bright green wings, or else in any balm or beauty of the earth, things to be cherished like the thought of heaven? Divinity must live within herself, passions of rain or moods in falling snow, grievings in loneliness or unsubdued elation when the forest blooms, gusty emotions on wet roads on autumn nights, all pleasures and all pains remembering the bough of summer and the winter branch. These are the measures destined for her soul. Jove in the clouds had his inhuman birth. No mother suckled him, no sweet land gave large-mannered motions to his mythy mind. He moved among us as a muttering king, magnificent would move among his hinds, until our blood, commingling, virginal with heaven, brought forth such requital to desire, the very hinds discerned it in a star. Shall our blood fail, or shall it come to be the blood of paradise? And shall the earth seem all a paradise that we shall know? The sky will be much friendlier then than now, a part of labor and a part of pain, and next in glory to enduring love, not this dividing and indifferent blue. She says, I am content when wakened birds, before they fly, test the reality of misty fields by their sweet questionings. But when the birds are gone and their warm fields return no more, where then is paradise? There is not any haunt of prophecy, nor any old chimera of the grave, neither the golden underground, nor isle melodious, where spirits get them home, nor visionary south, nor cloudy palm beneath on heaven's remote on heaven's hill, that has endured as April's green endures, or will endure like her remembrance of awakened birds, or her desire for June and evening, tipped by the consummation of the swallow's wings. She says, but in contentment, I still feel the need of some imperishable bliss. Death is the mother of beauty. Hence from her alone shall come fulfillment in our dreams and our desires. Although she strews the leaves of sure obliteration on our path, the path sick sorrow took, the many paths where triumph rang its brassy phrase or love whispered a little out of tenderness, she makes the willow shiver in the sun, or maidens who were wont to sit and gaze upon the grass, relinquished to their feet. She causes boys to pile new plums and pears on disregarded plate, the maidens taste and stray, impassioned in the littering leaves. Is there no change of death in paradise? Does ripe fruit never fall? Or do the boughs hang always heavy in that perfect sky, unchanging, yet so like our perishing earth, with rivers like our own that seek for seas they never find, the same receding shores that never touch with inarticulate pang? Why set the pear upon those river banks or spice the shores with odors of the plum? Alas, that they should wear our colors there, the silken weavings of our afternoons, and pick the strings of our insipid lutes. Death is the mother of beauty, mystical, within whose burning bosom we devise our earthly mothers waiting sleeplessly. Supple and turbulent, a ring of men shall chant in orgy on a summer morn, their boisterous devotion to the sun, not as a god, but as a god might be, naked among them, like a savage source. Their chant shall be a chant of paradise, out of their blood returning to the sky, and in their chant shall enter, voice by voice, the windy lake wherein their land delights. The trees like seraphim and echoing hills, that choir among themselves long afterward. They shall know well the heavenly fellowship of men that perish and of summer morn, and whence they came and whither they shall go, the dew upon their feet shall manifest. She hears upon that water without sound a voice that cries, the tomb in Palestine is not the porch of spirits lingering, it is the grave of Jesus where he lay. We live in an old chaos of the sun, an old dependency of day and night, or island solitude, unsponsored, free. Free of that wide water inescapable. Deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, and in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. That's my inspiring book.
Good morning. My name is Lori Miller, and I love to read. Surprisingly, I only started reading only about 4 or 5 years ago, actually when I retired. What am I going to do with my life? Well, senior center, hikes, gardening, ceramics. I had to throw in reading, writing. But with my new discovery of reading, I discovered the connections that I did not know prior to my life before reading. Connections with myself in the book, connections among the characters in the story, connections with the author writing the book, and connections with two readers discussing the book. Connections. That's what I discovered about reading. There is one book I did bring with you to talk about connections, my connection with this book. This is the first time I shared this story because I can't think of anybody better than this group to share this story with. Not everybody would totally understand what I'm saying, so I do appreciate the audience and bear witness to this. This book I rescued at a thrift store. I found it on a shelf and plucked it off. My intention was to craft a book, which means you take a book and you pull out the text and you throw in your pages. Could be my poetry. It could be blank pages you could write in a journal or put your photographs in, but you create a book. So I grabbed this book and I looked at the title and it's called Shadows, Storytelling. At that moment in my life, I also, part of my retirement, I started to do storytelling at the Douglas Morrison Theater. Some of us have told stories there as well. And it really connected the fact this book was all about storytelling. So I took it home, and I started reading the book a little bit. It appears to be, it's a children's book. And it's a stories about, it's called Shadows, and these shadows in Africa tell stories. The shadows from the hunters hiding in the sun. The shadows from the fire they dance around their village. Moon shadows. It was an incredible story about shadows and storytelling. And as I was reading this book, I discovered it was a library book. And Gail, in 1992, was the last child that checked out this book. Arnold loved this book. He checked it out 3 times. Ron John checked it out 2x. So this book became heart and soul. I was moved owning this book. It was a pretty incredible story, and it really, a book's a book, but I never was moved. I have not ever been moved as I have been before with this book. What threw me off having this book, little tiny print, it says deleted, is removed from the shelf. Yeah, I know. I was emotionally saddened to hear about this great book that was removed from the shelf, deleted, deselected, taken off the shelf. I sat by myself back in my craft room, placed my hand upon this book and dedicated myself to this book. I would take out the text, but I would treat it with respect. I took the text and put it on my bookshelf. I would treat this book with respect. And so by doing so, I am honored that I've been able to put my poetry in this book. So wherever I go and I might read or write my poetry, this book comes with me. So, again, I just wanted to share that with you, that books have heart and soul, and this one in particular with me. So thank you for bearing witness to that story.
Hi, I'm Doug Sprague, And I've lived in my world for almost 82 years and been quite content. But I want you to know that I've experienced during that time and been in hundreds of other worlds, thousands of other worlds. For example, the world of Frederick Stahl. You may not know him, but he's a famous movie star that in 1938 went to Paris to make a movie and was invited to Berlin to a film festival that Hitler was putting on. And this is part of his world when he was talking to one of the officials at the American Embassy in Paris. "You mentioned something," Stahl said, "the last time we spoke about information, about telling you if I found out something interesting, maybe important." "What are you saying, Mr. Stahl?" "Perhaps I could discover something if I went to Germany." "Oh, I doubt that. What would you do, meet a Wehrmacht general and try to get information?" "Say, General Schmidt, how's that new tank performing?" "Believe me, you'll just get into trouble." "Well, it was a thought." "Put it out of your mind. That's dangerous stuff, not for you." "Really? Why not for me?" "Spying is a brutal business, and if you get caught..." "What if there's a war and France is lost? What if I might have done something, anything, even a small thing, and didn't? What would I think of myself?" "I put that as a question, but the truth is I know the answer. These people, these Nazis are scum, Mr. Wilkinson. But from the perspective of being here in Europe, in Paris, it looks to me like they're winning." "They are right now. They are. And from somebody that knows a lot more than you do, they really are. But you say there's nothing I can do?" "Oh, I didn't quite say that." Then to the world of Father Darcourt. He's a professor at a university. "The principal excuse for my life, I suppose, that I am a good teacher. But to teach my best, I must have some peace of mind. Because I do not simply dole out lectures I prepared long ago. I engage my classes, which are never large, in talk and discussion. Every year, the shape of the work is different, and the result is different. Because as much depends on the quality of the students as depends on me. Cornish's posthumous demand costs too much in worry for me to teach at my best right now. I was particularly anxious to do so because of the first time in many years I had an exceptional student." And then we have Joe Harmon and Gene Padgett, who've come through World War II successfully, although it was brutal for them, and decided to get married. And they're having trouble deciding where to live, in London, where she's from, or from a ranch near a stinking town called Williston, where he's from. She said, "I'm afraid of changing your job. I can't believe that it would ever work out properly, that a man should change his work because his wife couldn't stand the conditions. You've been used to a property of 2,000 square miles, big, Joe, going off for 3 weeks at a time with pack horses and never going on your own land. What would a man like you do on 1,000 acres? He grinned weakly. She had put the finger on the spot. "Get accustomed to it pretty soon, I should think. I know you'd do it. You might even learn to do it reasonably well, but it could never satisfy you after the golf country. The cinemas won't fill the gap, or the streets of shop, or the dance hall. And sometimes when we shall squabble, Joe. You'll think about that old life in the golf country and how you had to give it up because of me. And I shall know you're thinking that and blaming it on me, and that will be between us all the time. That's what I'm afraid of, Joe. I think we ought to stay in the golf country where your work is." And Joe says, "What about the town?" "We'll have to do something about Williston," said Gene. And then the world of Paul Thoreau. In this particular time, he's going through a train trip through Asia and then back through Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And He is, reporting on this. I had only one objective in Burma. He's got to Burma. To take the northbound train from Rangoon via Mandalay and Mayo to the Göktürk Gorge in the Shan States, beyond which China sprawls. Across this gorge is a magnificent steel trestle bridge, the Viaduct, built in 1899 by the Pennsylvania Steel Company for the British Raw. And I want to see that. The next day he goes to the place to get tickets, and there's two men there, and both are uncertain about the Mandalay train. Departure 7 o'clock, morning time. There was one class, they said. I'll take a ticket to Mandalay. Sorry, the ticket window is closed. But the window was open. I mentioned this. Yes, it's been open so to say, but it's been closed for selling. You come back at 6 morning time. Are you sure I'll get a ticket? Maybe. Even much better to come at 5:30. How long does it take to get to Mandalay? 12 hours. But it breaks down. You might arrive Mandalay at 8. Or 9. They both laughed. Or 9, but not later. And you're going to see me in my world I'll sit down there for a while, and I'll socialize with you during social hour. I'll go home and have lunch and tend to Henry for a while, but I'll be looking forward to going out and having coffee by myself and reading a report by Mary Roberts Reinhardt, an author around the turn of the century, about her trip to France to check out the hospitals there for the Red Cross on whether the supplies were getting through and confronting all sorts of difficulties in there. So that's what I'll be looking for, is entering her world at about, I'd say, 4:15 this afternoon. Thank you.
I'd like to read a quote from Dr. Seuss. The more that you read, the more things you will know. The more you learn, the more places you'll go. And with that introduction, we're now going to proceed with the book communion. So if you'll come up row by row on the outside aisles to the front to choose your book to take home with you, and then proceed back down the center aisle back to your seat.